Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Doug Tribou.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. The year was 1934. The place, Needham, Massachusetts. The crime, a bank robbery, and the murder of two police officers cut down with a Tommy gun.
What followed was dogged police investigation and the arrest of four suspects, two Jewish brothers, an MIT graduate, and an 18-year-old minister's daughter, the beautiful Norma Brighton.
It was a saga of sex, ethnicity, bloodshed, and a sensational trial that captivated Depression-era Boston and much of the nation. Reporter Nathan Gorenstein tells the story in his new book, Tommy Gun Winter, Jewish Gangsters, a Preacher's Daughter, and the Trial That Shocked 1930s Boston. And Nathan Gorenstein, welcome to Radio Boston. It's great to have you. What a great story you've written.
I'm glad you've liked it. Thanks for having me.
So let's lay out some of the key characters here. The gang was led by two Jewish guys, two brothers, Merton Millen and his younger brother, Irv. So you describe Merton Millen as starting out as a small-time hoodlum. What kind of crimes are he and his brother involved with early on?
He and his brother ended up with the nicknames the Box Office Boys, because what Mert specialized in initially was knocking over movie theaters, and movie theaters were great cash cows. It was major public entertainment. And you could rob them, and there was never a guard there. He also got into taking hostages. He specialized in the technique where he would take a movie theater manager hostage. He did this a number of times, force him back to the office and to open the office safe.
Wow. Now, they're joined by Abe Faber, a graduate of MIT. So tell us something about Abe Faber.
Abe was a fascinating guy. He got into MIT in 1927, and what was fascinating about him was at that time, he was admitted into the aeronautical engineering program, and only 30 people a year were allowed in. And they were taught by the people who literally wrote the book on aeronautical engineering. But he is also maladjusted. He has difficulty making friends. He has an underlying temper, and he has issues, as later becomes clear, with his sexual identity.
So eventually this gang, they move on from movie box offices to bigger prey, right?
Right. Ultimately, Mert becomes more ambitious. He does that because he's just married in a very brief courtship, the daughter of a divorced minister, Norma Brighton, who had been voted the most beautiful girl in a high school class. And Mert suddenly needs money to support his wife and his lifestyle. When he married Norma, he threw over Abe. He and Abe had a very close emotional relationship, and there was testimony how Abe used to climb into Mert's bedroom window at night. But when Mert married Norma, Abe suddenly found himself on the outs, and Abe finds that the way to get back in with Mert, he hopes, is to go with him on crimes. Up until now, Mert's never killed anyone. He never resorted to violence, but this time, and the first time that Abe comes with him, he kills a guy, and he finds out that he likes it. As he says later, "For my first job, I'm a pretty good shooter." And then they rob a state police exhibit of a Thompson submachine gun, four shotguns, a variety of other weapons, and they decide to go after a bank.
I want to hear more about Norma Brighton, this beautiful 18-year-old son, daughter of a minister. Tell us more about her. What attracts her to Millen and this criminal enterprise?
Well, it's fascinating. She was the daughter of divorced parents, and in those days, a divorced minister was really not the norm. And Norma, when she was 17, 18, found that her father didn't want her to date, didn't want her to dance, wanted her to stay at home, and he lived out in Natick, which at that time was a far more rural community than it is now. And she bridled at his restrictions. And she meets Mert at a dance hall in Nantasket Beach in the summer of 1933. And Mert, as many people with his psychological inclination, is a charmer. And within 2 weeks, he has her living in an apartment in Boston.
So their crime wave comes to this awful climax on February 2nd, 1934, a bank robbery and the murder of two Needham cops, Francis Haddock and Forbes McLeod. What happened?
What happened was that this crime took place at the height of the gangster era, and Boston police had just announced that Pretty Boy Floyd was in the territory staking out new places to rob. So when this Thompson machine gun robbery takes place, the first of its kind in Massachusetts history, there's an enormous panic and enormous anger. What had happened in the morning, they drove to Needham. The three guys walked into the bank. They had it timed so they would be shielded by a a commuter train that parked on the tracks in front of the bank, hiding it from downtown. But just as the train pulled away, Mert looked up and saw Forbes McCloud walking up towards the bank and crossing the tracks. And he opens fire with the Thompson, kills McCloud. He dies a couple of hours later at the hospital. Mm. They flee the bank with two hostages on the running boards of their car. And as they're going out of town, another police officer who's alerted by telephone sees the car coming up the street with one of the hostages still on the running board. Starts to pull his gun, walk down towards it, and Mert fires the Thompson from the moving car with one hand, wounds and kills that officer, Francis Haddock.
This is really sort of Bonnie and Clyde stuff, isn't it? I mean, people on running boards shooting Tommy guns, robberies, getaways.
Which was why it produced the uproar it did in Boston. There were seven competing newspapers at that time. And two of the reporters who got involved, one from the Globe, one from the Boston Post, also ultimately helped solve the case.
Mm. And how was it ultimately solved? Because eventually a police investigation does lead to their arrest.
There's two very smart, ambitious newspaper reporters combined with two very good state police detectives. One of the state police detectives realizes that he can trace a battery that was found inside the burnt-out getaway car. With the help of the newspaper reporters, who were the first to identify the Millens as being involved in the case, there's two consecutive, simultaneous, but coincidental arrests. One up in Boston, led by the first Italian-American on the Massachusetts State Police Force, Joe Ferrari, convinces Abe to turn over. And at the same time, down in New York City, the second Massachusetts detective, John Stokes, is leading a group of guys who stake out a hotel lobby and, after a struggle, capture Mert, Irv, and Norma in New York City. And there's a famous photograph, which I guess you guys might have on your website, of Norma, Abe, and Mert in New York City police headquarters.
Mm. And this leads to a rather spectacular trial. What makes this trial such a spectacle in Boston?
It turned out to be the longest murder trial up to that time in state history, 8 weeks. It was marked by a soap opera. The families of the two boys, or the three boys, I'm sorry, decided the only way they could save their lives, not keep them out of jail because they were going to get life sentences, was to destroy their own reputations in public, claiming both families were riddled with insanity. And there's a remarkable effort by the Millens, led by the older sister, to convince the jury that the family has a long history of mental illness, that their father is a violent brute, their mother is mentally ill, and everyone takes the witness stand and describes this horrendous upbringing. That stuff just wasn't done in public and courts. This was remarkable.
Well, Merton Millen, his brother Irv, and Abe Faber are all convicted, mm-hmm. sentenced to death, put to death in the electric chair. What happened to Norma Brighton, the beautiful Norma Brighton?
She clearly knew what the gang was up to and clearly helped them out. She got a year in jail as an accessory. The judge said he wouldn't let her out until after her husband was dead. They were all executed one after the other on midnight July 7th, 1935. The last words of Irv were, I salute my brother Merton, which gives you an idea of the bond between the two of the guys.
Mm.
Norma gets out and marries a musician. They have a son. The son, he commits himself to a state psychiatric institution in North Jersey. And 2 years later, there's another woman admitted, and he kills her. And he is then sent to a institution for the criminally insane, where he hangs himself. And of all the things that I discovered during my research, that was sort of the most shocking, because it was though this kid inherited all the bad karma that had come before.
Boy. Nathan, you're an investigative reporter, mm-hmm. so naturally you're drawn to a great story. But it turns out you've got a family connection to this story because you're related to the Millen brothers.
Right. Mert and Irv are my first cousins twice removed. What that means is that my grandmother's brothers and sisters were their first cousins, their peers. They had went on double dates with them. My grandmother was asked to testify at the trial. She refused.
But what was it like growing up with this story as part of your family background? I mean, did folks talk about it? Was it taboo?
It was taboo. It was never spoken about. The only mention that until, again, I was probably a sophomore in college, and one night my grandmother let loose there was a bank robber in the family. And she also told me that I look like him. I look like the bank robber. And I...
Do you think that's true? We've got a picture of him.
Well, is that true? You have to look at me when I was 22, 23, 24 with all my hair and my face very different. But years later, in 1998, when I spent a couple of months looking into this, I went into the Needham police station unannounced, and very nice guy who's now retired, Wayne Urquhart. He was sort of the de facto historian. And I went in unannounced to see him. And he starts off very annoyed that I'm disturbing him. And then he hears my grandmother's name, and he takes me upstairs, and he says, "So what are you doing?" And I explain what I'm up to. And the first thing he says afterwards is, "You look like him."
Wow. So this is really sensational stuff. I'm wondering, finally, if you think at all about the parallels or contrasts with the current trial that we're following here in Boston of the Marathon bomber. Sensational crime, much followed trial. I'm just wondering, how has the criminal justice system changed since the 1930s and the story of the Millen brothers?
It's a fascinating question. On one hand, the issues are very much the same. Insanity, to what extent was one brother influenced by another brother? Mm-hmm. When I first found out about the story, yes, it was intriguing because it was the family. But as I got into it, I became fascinated by the events that were so problematic and so improbable. There was the relationship between the three men. There was the minister's daughter. There was the investigation. And it's a tale that integrates so many of the things that even now, shall we say, obsess America, you know, race, ethnicity in this case, religion, Judaism, sexual identity, law enforcement. And then ultimately, you know, what happens to people and families when they're faced with this kind of media onslaught. None of the families ever recovered. Abe Faber's mother killed herself. Joe Millen, the father, died alone in his house in Roxbury. And no one in the family except one person, there were six living siblings, ever had children.
Wow. Well, Nathan Gorenstein is a former investigative reporter with the Philadelphia Inquirer. His new book is Tommy Gunn Winter, Jewish Gangsters, a Preacher's Daughter, and the Trial That Shocked 1930s Boston. Nathan, thanks so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And stay with us. Coming up, our food series, Farm to Fork, goes from goat to cheese. I'm Doug Tribou.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.